Hugo Bolgin is a former corporate hotel executive who is also the founder of Eagle Vision Consulting, a consulting and leadership development company helping companies create sustainable business models by becoming socially and environmentally responsible. He's the author of a recent book, In the Eyes of Anahita, published by Eagle Vision, 2095 Canadian. Mr. Bolgin was born in Antwerp, Belgium, and lives in Calgary, where he joins us this morning. Please welcome to the commentary.ca Hugo Bolgin. Good morning, Mr. Bolgin.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us. I finished the book, I guess it was Sunday night, and I was struck at how well it was written and how it is rather suspenseful. Mm-hmm. And talk to me about Paul and this journey that he goes on in South America.
Well, Paul really is a character, the main character in the book, and he's really based on me, essentially, and on the experiences that I went through. He's a business executive who deals with the richest people in South America, and on his journeys he gets confronted with an ever-increasing degree of poverty that he encounters. And it really makes him question a lot of things in his life and actually in the world. And essentially it leads him to question the role that he's playing in the world as a business executive.
It's an existential sort of crisis that he goes through, also a spiritual one.
Absolutely.
You said it was inspired by you. How much of Paul is you, actually?
Well, most events in the book actually did happen to me. They did not necessarily happen in that sequence of events. Like, for me, things took place over a three-year period, and they were all separate events, whereby in the book I put them together as a two-week mystical adventure story. And there is a fiction element that does tie it all together to keeps the pace in the story. But most of the separate events, most of the events all did happen.
You talked to an oracle and a hummingbird?
No.
Yeah.
Although the oracle and the hummingbird do represent certain elements. Like the oracle, for instance, that shows up in the book is really that it was something I created when I was writing, when I noticed that at times I sat in front of the computer and there was almost stuff coming in that I was typing, and I'm thinking, like, where does this stuff come from?
Yeah.
And that's where actually the idea from the oracle comes from. And I think in a certain way that I intended it to be in the book, it's something that all of us are familiar with. Like from time to time we could be driving or we could be doing something, we can ask ourselves a question and suddenly the answer just pops in our head. Well, that's the oracle.
Sort of the conscious.
Yes.
The conscience. As an author, do you think that Paul could have gleaned everything that he learned and found out on his trip in South America if the story was set, let's say, in Asia or Europe or North America?
I think actually any developing country, like the setting could take place in any other developing country or parts of the world where you have that type of poverty. I think to go to the same setting in North America or Europe would be and go through the same experience would be very difficult. Like as I said, most of the things are actually experience based for me, and the 8 years prior to my travels in South America, my 2 year business position in South America, I traveled all over Europe and North America, and I never really, I was aware of some of these things in the world, but when you walk the slums and things are just all the way around you and you experience it, it becomes a whole different thing, and you can't just rationalize things away anymore.
So this was a life-altering experience for you. You were a hotel executive. Did that prompt you to make changes in your own life after having gone through this?
Absolutely. I actually left my corporate position as a result of those things. When I walked, the final straw, in, as you well know, is described in the book as well, was really when I walked the slums in Salvador, the Bahia in Brazil, and I saw a child basically playing in open sewage water. And at that point, I just had to think about my own children. And there was a number of things that already, by that point, led me to question what I was doing. But at that point in time, I really had to say, okay, how do I justify what I see? And I simply could not justify it. And if you can't justify what you see, the next question is, so what do you do about it? And I actually concluded I was more part of the problem in the world than part of the solution.
Well, we'll talk about the accumulation of wealth and material goods in just a sec, but in the book it took Paul about 2 weeks, you said. How long did it take you to make this transition and this thought process?
2 years.
Really? And did I assume that you spent a lot of time in South America because of your work?
Yes, like I, over that 2 year period, I actually spent more time out of the country here than, and actually in South America than I actually was living in Canada.
Did your wife and your kids eventually go to South America with you?
No, they didn't know, and it's still one of those things that, like my oldest is 15 at this point, and, you know, before he's leaving the house, I really want to take the family down there, and I've got a fairly adventurous journey in mind. I want to cross South America with them so that they can experience and see some of the things that I see.
Now, Paul's son, Tom, asked the key question, why do people pay for food?
Mm-hmm.
Did that happen to you, too?
Yes. My son actually, or one of my sons actually asked me that question when he was seven, which was about a year before I started traveling there. And to this day, it is one of the most profound questions I have heard.
And then you don't have an answer for it, do you? It's very hard to find an answer for such a potent question, I guess.
Yes. I mean, it's... Why do people have to pay for food? I think really it is because we've created a system that somehow falls short of taking humanitarian needs into account.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, and I found it quite striking and haunting even now that I think about the book having finished it, is the eyes that you encountered, or that Paul encountered, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about that, and was that a personal experience, meeting all these people, or was this some sort of literary device?
Actually, that was a personal experience. It's the first time when I encountered those eyes was actually in Salta, Argentina, and the entire situation that I described with the old woman on the street did happen, and it's probably the most mysterious thing that ever happened in my life. It was eerie, it was weird. But when I looked, I got out of the taxi, and I turned around, and I look into this old Incan woman who's essentially begging there, like somebody's grandmother. And when I looked into her eyes, it was... I told my wife, as soon as I phoned her, I said, you know, it's like I've looked into the eyes of God. I mean, it was an amazing experience. And then when I came back out of the hotel, when I wanted to give her something, she was gone, and the streets were empty. It was strange.
So these mysterious eyes that you saw in children, in women, that Paul saw in the book, eventually, is that God?
I think it is an aspect of it, yes. It's like the old woman who was begging on the streets in the slums in Salvador. That actually did not happen in Salvador. It happened to me in Mexico, in Monterrey. But she was sitting there, and she had the same eyes. And it was... there's something in there, something so pure and so... so mysterious at the same time that it, I think it really touches people deeply. And I've started to pay much more attention when I encounter people in my life now to very interesting how you can really see people's energy level, and you can see a lot in people's eyes when you really start paying attention to it. And in South America, people seem to have much more passion in those eyes than most people have here in North America still, except for the children.
I don't want to give away something that happens at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, you'll excuse how I tread carefully as I ask this next question. Again, about the eyes, how, as I said, I don't want to give away the story, so why do you think it is then that this passion, this sort of innocence, this sort of feeling that this is God, is only seen in the eyes of people in South America who are poor, who are destitute, rather than, let's say, people who are trying to make money and accumulate wealth in North America?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it has to do with something I touched on in the book, some of the previous chapters before that encounter. And it really is about the ability to live in the moment and to enjoy the present. And in North America, and actually pretty much, it's not just in North America, it happens in South America as well with people that more with the rich there than with the poor. If you don't have anything like the poor, then you take every day as it comes, and you really tend to live in the moment and enjoy every moment you can have and celebrate whatever little things that come to you. When you start to accumulate wealth and possessions, we tend to live with our hearts in the past and hang on to the good times we have, and with our heads in the future in order to think about all the things that could happen to the stuff that we already have and really predict that, and we miss the present moment altogether. And that having our minds in the future the whole time really brings with it worries and fear and those things which people who don't have anything, they don't spend their time thinking about that anymore.
Are you saying then that the rich, the people that have material goods, aren't happy?
I think a lot of them aren't. I mean, if you simply look at the depression rate in North America, I mean, Prozac is one of the most widely sold drugs in North America. I think that in itself tells enough. I mean, put that in context with the fact that it is, you know, North America is one of the most wealthy places on Earth. Well, those two don't exactly fit well together, do they?
Right. What about this stuff that we hear, medical research and the sort in this country and elsewhere, that depression is a chemical thing? Do you think that the pursuing of material goods, wealth, that affects us physically?
I think it does. I mean, there's clearly there's as much research and evidence that stress levels, which are the result of having your head in the future and worrying about things and those elements, that stress levels basically do affect the physical body, which in turn obviously have a result on a chemical level. And I mean, one of the things that I always find interesting with that type of research is that, you know, they can actually make the correlation to see that, you know, depression and links to a certain chemical cause, but nobody ever can say what comes first, because this is a chicken and egg situation, and they don't exactly know what is causing exactly what. And like if you go and look at old Chinese and Taoist practices, which have been confirmed now as well, if you, your body language, if you actually force yourself to smile, that actually has an effect on the release of certain chemicals in your body, which will make you feel better. So it works, but I mean, the two are correlated, but you can, what's leading to what is more unclear.
We're talking with Hugo Bolgin. His book is called In the Eyes of Anahita. It's published by Eagle Vision, $20.95 Canadian. Do you think that, you've come to some sort of epiphany here. Why do you think other people haven't come to where you are in this state of mind about the world and about the world that you live in?
Well, I think since I wrote the book, I traveled through Canada and really done quite a number of book signings. And I've encountered quite a number of people that have traveled to developing countries, either in South America or Asia, and really have come to the same or similar conclusion. And so if I could bring the entire world over there, you know, then I'd like to do that, because it would certainly change people's mindsets and perspectives on life considerably. But since that is not possible, I mean, the next best thing is really to try and bring that world to people, which is why I wrote the book. In leadership programs that I've run in the past, I've always said people's lives change considerably once they undergo what I call significant emotional experiences. And so when you see poverty at such a scale from close by, that is one of those experiences that people go through at that point. The book basically tries to bring that world to people, and it's written as a novel so that I can, because it allows me to talk to people's hearts rather than to their mind. There's a lot of good non-fiction books written on the subject that talk to people's minds, but I want to affect people on an emotional level, and so far from the response I'm getting back from readers, it seems to have that effect.
There are two more questions that you ask and that are asked in the book on the lines of why do people pay for food, and that is, are human beings human, mm-hmm. as well as is a global society a social globe? Would you expand on those for the benefit of my listeners who may be interested in picking up the book and how you work to answering those two very strong questions, very evocative questions?
Well, are human beings being human is actually a question that I started to ask myself as I traveled through South America. And I guess the most funny thing was when I asked myself the question was that I had no idea what being human stood for. And so as I started to research that aspect of it and looked into the dictionary and found out where the root of it was, I came to all of these different angles until somebody said to me, well, you know, it all depends upon how you look at it from a cultural perspective as well and what people really perceive. And so it became this really, I thought, interesting question to explore. That aspect links to a lot of interpersonal things and how we as people relate to other people around us. The second question, is global society a social globe, really takes that a level further, because once you get to interpersonal relationships, if you blow that up, you get to really societal issues or global issues. And to me, the two, I mean, it's a question people ask a lot, is why do you combine those two into one book? And I always answer that question by saying that, you know, we will never be able to solve global problems and world issues if we can't deal with each other on a one-on-one level or a community level properly. And so that's why the two of them are addressed in the book.
Is it, though, North Americans' fault that all this is happening in the world, that there is poverty and environmental degradation, the race to the bottom, for example, in countries like Peru and Argentina and Chile? Is it all capitalism's doing?
No. It is not. Capitalism is definitely an aspect of it. But there's other elements like corruption of government in developing countries that basically don't facilitate things. But I really wanted to look at, I wanted to take the perspective in the book as to what can we do here and now. There's a lot of organizations and a lot of actions that focus on the trade agreements and political situations of those elements, but they really don't. They don't allow everybody on the street to take action today. I mean, yes, we can write a letter to the Prime Minister or something like that, but that's about where it ends. And so what I wanted to do with the book is really empower people to say, okay, what is it that we can do right now in our world to make a difference?
And is that 4-step process to transitioning to a more humane world?
Yes.
And what are those 4 steps?
There's really a number of different elements, but we really need to start looking at how we interact on an economic level with the world around us as investors, as consumers, and as business people. And if we start to implement the ethics that we all have into our day-to-day lives, as players in an economic model, the world would get quite a different shape, and that's really the essence of the matter.
Hugo, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a very thought-provoking book, and I enjoyed speaking with you today, and I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Not a problem at all.
And continued good luck with your book.
Thank you.
The book is called In the Eyes of Anahita, 2095 Canadian, published by Eagle Vision. The author, Hugo Bolgen, here on the commentary.